Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Today's episode is titled A City Made Through Displacement, and I am delighted to introduce you to our speakers for today, which is Dr. Sylvia Ahmed Kakar, who is a lecturer at the Department of Sociology at the University of Essex. She is also a member of the advisory board at Karachi Urban Lab in Pakistan. Sylvia is an interdisciplinary urban studies scholar whose research focuses on the lived experiences of insecurity and uncertainty in the global south. We also have another speaker today, Sibdul Hassan, who is a PhD student at the Center for Conflict Studies, Philipps Marburg University in Germany, and his focus is on land governance in Pakistan's tribal areas. He's been associated with the Awami Workers Party and the All Pakistan Alliance for Kachi Abadis. He is also involved with the Emancipatory Rural Politics Initiative, or ERPI South Asia Collective, which is a group of activists and scholars working on topics revolving around agrarian political economy. Welcome to the podcast, both of you.
Thank you for having us, Romolo.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start with talking about your project, which is a GCRF REC action research project titled Uncertainty and Insecurity of Tenure, Developing Infrastructures of Care and Resistance in Islamabad, Pakistan. So I wanted to ask, how did it come about and how did your collaboration with the Alliance for Urban Rights come about?
Thank you for introducing the project, Romola. So it was actually a project that was very personal for many reasons. The first being that I grew up in Islamabad. It's the only city I've known. My parents moved there in 83. That's the same year I was born. It was a very small city, clean and green, neat and tidy, well-ordered, very much in contrast to what every other city in Pakistan was like, especially the major sort of provincial capitals. So, you know, the teeming megacities of Karachi, Lahore, Rawalpindi, or the mess that, you know, sometimes you would see in Peshawar and Quetta, you'd never see that in Islamabad. It was very neatly ordered and planned. It was a city where most residents were either belonging to the government or sort of to the bureaucracy or to the military. It was only, I think, when I left in Islamabad in 2007, I moved to Karachi and then to Lahore and then to London. And I would go back every year to visit when I saw how much the city had started to transform year after year. And this sort of was especially interesting for me because of my new distance to the city. So I started studying Karachi, the megacity, because Islamabad was so boring in contrast. And all of a sudden, you know, as I was finishing up my project in Karachi, I started thinking, wow, like, look what's happening in Islamabad. So the city had grown massively from about just of being under a million when I was a teenager in 1998. To being over 2 million residents in 2017. So that's a very short span of time and a very rapid expansion. And my PhD ended in 2015. By this time, I was a mom as well. I had a young child. My parents lived in Islamabad. It was, you know, again, like I said, home. And I used to follow the news, and I was still living at a distance, of the massive eviction drives happening in the informal settlements, the Kachi Abadis, in Islamabad. And it was excruciating because, I mean, you could see the violence with which, these settlements were being destroyed. There was a concerted effort of criminalizing most of the residents that lived in these abadis. And it was very, it was very stark the way in which these settlements were represented in news and media as dirty, as polluting the city, as being the source of trouble and conflict. So it was shocking at how stark those comparisons were and how blatantly they were being made. And around the same time, like I said, when you're sat in a distance, you're an urban scholar, you're interested in cities, I started following videos and content that was produced by the All Pakistani Kachi Abadi Alliance, which was a loosely organized alliance of lawyers and academics and policymakers and sort of activists and community members. And these videos were inspiring. I mean, they had this sort of idea of emancipation, about activism, about mobilizing sort of residents of these communities. They were able to present sort of the real image of, how these communities were being destroyed by the evictions. So I was very moved by that. And I wanted to kind of, intervene in some way. And that's how I got in touch with the All Pakistani Kachi Abadi Alliance through their Facebook page. In 2017, I started working at Goldsmiths as well. I learned that they had funding through the GCRF to do some kind of collaborative work in countries that were eligible. That's how I started communicating with colleagues at the All Pakistani Kachi Abadi Alliance, one of whom, Amar, responded immediately. And because when I visited home next, we sat together in his drawing room with our kids playing with each other, discussing what was going on. And him and his wife, Jacqueline, we talked a lot about the All Pakistani Kachi Abadi Alliance's work. I talked about my political interests and my own sort of research interests and how sort of, my access to this funding could really help, make some kind of, or develop some kind of infrastructure of care between these sort of loosely organized, unfunded volunteer organizations and other broader movements within and across Pakistan. So it was really a way to kind of, enable some kind of voice to the community, enable some kind of, allow volunteers to be paid for the work that they were doing in generating knowledge on those communities, raising awareness, strengthening networks of organizations, between settlements, because sometimes, this sort of horizontal collaboration did not exist, also connecting them to vertical sort of infrastructures of collaborations, and to just disseminate, knowledge that these organizations had held and gathered and gained, but didn't have the funding to kind of really push out. So that's what the project was about, really. I mean, maybe Hassan can say something about sort of, his version of the city and the alliance and the project as well.
Yeah, I moved into in Islamabad in 2013 after finishing my studies in Peshawar. The reason was, actually I come from Pakistan's tribal areas. So during that time, Pakistan was going through a lot of violence, especially our hometown, and we were stuck in our campuses. So what was happening that our hometown is connected. I come from Kurram district, which is connected through only a single road to the rest of Pakistan. So Taliban had blocked that road, so we were stuck in. Most of the students were stuck in the hostel. So, and also the war was not shown. It was in the media. It was depicted as a group between two conflict between two groups. It was not properly covered because Pakistani military information black hole. So then I, along with the students from my hometown, we were quite active. We used to do protests in Peshawar to open the roads. That's how I got active. And then after finishing my degree in Peshawar, our lives were in under threat because of the target killing. Since we were in back home, we were our tribe was resisting Taliban onslaught. So they started targeting students in of our tribe in the Peshawar. So most of the people from our tribe who were living in Peshawar, who public working in the government sector or NGOs, they migrated from Peshawar into Islamabad. So that's how I also, after finishing my degree, I moved into Islamabad for my job search. But then since I, at that time, I was very active on the ground also, and then I got somehow connected to the activists who are Pashtun activists, mostly active in Islamabad. So then I joined a group where, of Pashtuns who used to protest against ongoing violence in Pashtun areas and also police harassment in the cities. So one of the activists who used to work with the Al Pakistan Kachi Abadi Alliance, and I am also a photographer, so I had a camera, and then he started inviting me to the Al Pakistan Kachi Abadi Alliance meetings. That's how we, by that time, around 2013 and 14, we made social media pages and also started like putting videos and pictures on the social media. So then whenever there would be a meeting, he would invite me, and gradually, slowly, I started getting involved in the process. And then, as Subia mentioned, that in 2015, there was an operation going on. So I was briefly arrested during that operation. I spent 4 days in a jail. They snatched my camera, and I didn't get that back. So all the pictures which you see on the from 2013 till 2000 mostly 15 and 16, it was mostly I and Ashraf Kakkad who were involved, and Fayaz Qayyum and other activists. I was mostly involved doing pictures, and they were more involved with doing videos. And at the end, we were able to make a documentary, which is called Invisible Islamabad.
Yeah, that's an interesting segue to the second reason why this is a personal project to me, because I had... when I saw these documentaries in 2015, I was shocked at how invisible these Abadis actually were. I lived in Islamabad all my life. I never knew that there were so many Kachi Abadis in the city. Villages, they were well known because, you know, they had a different sort of ties to the city in terms of producing and sort of selling milk or, you know, sort of other sort of similar agrarian goods. So it was very embarrassing for me as an urban studies scholar, like to just realize that, you know, and also it really sort of reflected my own positionality as a middle class urban resident, like Hassan jokingly. I mean, he's been kind not to mention it now, but he started by saying that, you know, we were very different residents. You're the burger and I'm, you know, I'm not. So, yeah, I'm very conscious of my own positionality. So the fact that in 2015, there were 52 Kachi Abadis in Islamabad, only 11 of them were recognized. And I might have maybe known only about 5 or 6 of them. So that really was eye-opening for me. And the second sort of emotional bit was where at the writing up stage of my PhD, some of my, which was on sort of enclaves in Karachi, I'd been looking at sort of informal settlements, which were riddled by violence and insecurity. And I was very much sort of obviously benefiting from the knowledge that people in those settlements were giving me. But while I was writing up my PhD, I found out very late that a couple of my interlocutors had died because of that violence. They had been killed. And the guilt of not sort of having known until I reached out to find out about a question and called someone and couldn't get through and then called other people. And also, I realized my own importance or lack of in the lives of these people, because I wasn't able to change it in any way. I wasn't able to, like, nobody needed to inform me, because who was I after all? So it really led me to a point of introspection of how can I work with communities that are disadvantaged, that are marginal, but I've benefited from them as an academic because of the knowledge I've taken away from them without actually having made any positive change in their lives. So for that reason, this project felt like a important thing to do as now a post PhD sort of academic. Even though I had a fixed term sort of contract at the time, I felt I had access to grants and funding, which I could really source and give to these organizations to do real meaningful work. As part of this, project, we built, first we formalized the All Pakistan Kachiabadi Alliance, which was a loosely built network of volunteers. But we also they were able to formalize as a charity, which was retitled as the Alliance for Urban Rights. And this alliance is now sort of purely the research sort of wing of the Alliance for All Pakistan Alliance for Kachiabadis. They're able to source and grant other funding from other organizations now that they're formed. We, as part of this project, were able to collate the previous information that the All Pakistani Kachiabadi had on the Facebook page, which was susceptible to being blocked by the government because of policing and repression. So now they're able to host themselves and put all their different knowledges in one sort of kind of a database that's publicly accessible to policymakers, to researchers. Also we were able to document and map some of these Abadis, which was very important because that knowledge making itself is an act of activism, where these Abadis can then lay claim to their permanency by talking about how historically rooted they are. And then finally, we, as part of the building infrastructures of care and in forms of resistance, we created a toolkit, which created a sort of, it was a small pamphlet, you could say, that was for the benefit of the communities, that was created with the help of communities after learning their survival strategies or ways that they can sort of mobilize, speaking to the lawyers of the AUR, speaking of the researchers, media personnel, activists, about sort of basic training of what they can do if they feel under threat, who they can reach out to, contact numbers, of people, organizations, media personnel, strategies. And this was a collaborative project with community members that was then shared with community members. It was translated into Urdu as well. It's freely available as a PDF on the website, but it was also physically distributed to the populations. So it was just a knowledge making and sharing exercise, but also an exercise that brought people together, formalized them. And that was the background to the project.
Wow, that sounds like a really interesting project. And I think one of the things that is really quite striking is how the two of you have kind of come to work on this together, that Hassan came from a different part of Pakistan, had been involved in activism there, and then came to Islamabad and became involved in the activism here as well around these questions of evictions. And yet you were living there for some time, but then it took for you to go away, come back as part of your research to see and recognize what was going on and then become involved as well. So it's quite interesting, certainly as a geographer, to sort of think about how different places relate to each other. Because you were talking about Islamabad in a very particular way when you started out, I was wondering if you could give us a background to the history of the city and how that relates to the question of displacement.
Absolutely, yes. I could take this question. Islamabad was built as a capital city of Pakistan. It wasn't the historical capital. When Pakistan was created, Karachi was the capital. But like I mentioned, Karachi was a mess, political, social, economic. Like, it was just too volatile, or it was thought to be too volatile. Islamabad was built in the 1960s to replace Karachi. The model for the city was planned by Doxiadis, the Greek architect and planner, who drew Islamabad along modernist planning principles. It's very similar to, I've never been, but people say Chandragarh in India or Brasilia, so it's neatly organized in this sort of grid pattern with sort of nice segmented sort of, big streets and little streets and like little market areas in each sector. It's organized by sectors. And it has like an alphabet and a numerical, and it's an interesting city in that respect about how well planned it is or was actually. But it's also interesting to remember that because it was a city that was built in the 60s, it's a city that was built through displacement in the first place. So there were numerous villages that were always in Islamabad, but they had to be contained. Land had to be taken ownership of and possession of. And some of these villages, land might have formally passed through ownership to the Capital Development Authority, which was the CDA. We might use that acronym as well, which was made to kind of make the plan happen. So the CDA was able to formally legally take ownership of some of these villages, but it never took full legal possession. And that became one of the contentions between some of the villages that currently exist and sort of where people who are indigenous to Islamabad continue to resist evictions from, because they say that they've been given partial payment that related to the former legal ownership, but they haven't been paid the full current, you know, the full amount of money that would have been along current real estate prices for full possession. And that amount is quite exorbitant because Islamabad has one of the highest sort of real estate value in, you know, in Pakistan, especially within the central city sectors and districts. So there's a financial sort of, you could say, tussle between village owners and sort of inhabitants who never left the city, because they were also quite aware of the value of the land that they were inhabiting. And for the longest time, they were allowed to sort of live there through the normal corruption channels where, you know, certain officials might just look over the fact that they still inhabit and live these places, and they might sort of put money in aside, they might move them from here to there. But when some of these sectors sort of came to development, some of these came to development very recently, like the ones next to the Margola Hills in B12 or, you know, 11. And this is when the evictions in, around sort of 2010 onwards really took up, picked up pace. And, you know, the issue of, you know, these people and who the rightful owners are, they came into question. And the second story of displacement is, of course, when you're building a city, you need labor to live in the city. So, you know, in the 70s, 60s and 70s, there was a labor colony in G83, one of the sectors. And this camp sort of obviously became more and more permanent as construction kept pace, because not only was the city itself built, but then houses within the city were getting built, and, you know, people needed, you know, day laborers and, like, you know, construction workers and whoever not. But, you know, when the time came to construct one of the planned hospitals in the city, it's called PIMS, this colony was evicted. And at that time, these laborers were offered sort of houses or colonies in, you know, houses and colonies, which were like by the rivers or like little streams, like, you know, the unwanted parts of the city in sectors G and F. So the Christians were housed in particular ones. Now these Abadis were settled along religion, you could say, the Christians in some ones and then Muslims in others. And at this time in the 70s, this one Abadi or this one Kachi Abadi was displaced and 11 new Abadis were formed. And those are the ones that the CDA recognizes. And these are because, you know, it has on its sort of knowledge base, or, you know, it's got public papers that show how this population was resettled elsewhere. But the ones that have been constructed since then are now not being recognized. But, you know, these displacements continue to the present day in line with developments. Hassan was just telling me about one around the 10th Avenue. Hassan, maybe you could talk about that one.
Actually, there is a body called it's called Rimsha Colony. So it's the name of the colony derives from the girl whose name was Rimsha. So what happened in 2012, a Christian minor girl who living in Merabadi slum near F11 sector, she was accused by Muslim clerk of Bless Mami. So what happened that Merabadi is predominantly Muslim slum. So what happened, because of the fear of attacks from the Muslims, the whole Christian community moved into H92, which is now called, it took the name of the Rimsha Colony because it got displaced of that incident. Later it came out after an investigation that she was falsely accused of blasphemy, and the clerk was the Muslim clerk was arrested, and then because of the circumstances in Pakistan and the blasphemy issue, the Rimsha was relocated into Canada, I think. Yeah, but then what happened that before the arrival of the Rimsha colony, this H9 sector, there was already another Christian colony who moved here in 2010 when CD carried out a demolition campaign. They started a demolition campaign where they demolished a Christian Abadi near Rawal Lake. So they were the first one who moved to that place. And then Rimsha, Christians from the Merabadi, they moved in 2012 after that incident. So you can see there has been cyclical evictions happening in the city. And now Pakistan government has started a new project. They are building, they are widening roads and making flyovers. So now again, this community, this Kachiabadi is again under threat. For the last 2 years, there were threats and activists of the Al-Pakistan Kachiabadis, they and AUR, they've been involved, they've been attending the EIA meetings. But for now, since the pace of the project is quite slow, so far the community is also not that much threatened. I don't know. It was very weird. Like when we started going over there, I was also there. We started attending, started mobilizing the people, but then people were not threatened. I don't know. It was very weird. But it also, it's something which is not quite new also in those Abadis. There were some, of course, there most of these, this Abadi has a lot of Chaudhrys. So Chaudhrys are like neighborhood gatekeepers. So most of them, they are associated with different mainstream political parties. So in that Abadi, one of the former federal minister, Christian federal minister, Jay Salik, he's been quite active over there. So somehow he placated, somehow he was able to, he got involved, and then he assured them that the Abadi will not be evicted. So since I said that the pace of the project is quite slow, so we don't know what will happen to them. But you can see like how people are just being evicted in circles.
So I wanted to ask then, what kinds of resettlement schemes are there for the residents of these Kachiabadis who are being displaced? Or are there any resettlement schemes for them? What does the state expect is going to happen to those who are displaced? Where do they think they're going to go?
That's a really good question, Ramola. I think it's quite, Islamabad is quite interesting and peculiar than, you know, as well in some ways, and I'll explain how. But before I do that, I also want to sort of highlight, you know, what is the state, you know, and whose interest does it serve? I mean, it's a typical sort of political sort of question. And but also to think about how it changes with time and context, and, you know, sometimes with activism as well. So I think it's also important how in the 80s, when there was a whole drive of more international sort of understanding, you know, through UNDP and similar sort of institutions around sort of rehabilitation and resettlement, about sort of formalizing irregular settlements. In some cases at that time, you know, in Karachi, lots of Kachiabadis were becoming formalized through the Sindh Kachiabadi Act. And this was thought to be a way to solve that urban problem of unplanned city and irregular settlements, and how to kind of provide housing for masses of working class or sort of, you know, poor urban residents who couldn't afford housing otherwise, and where the state's capacities were very limited in developing new housing or low cost housing. So that sort of wave, was very sort of apparent in Karachi and sort of Lahore as well. And then you had sort of resettlement within residential centers. I mean, this could also, like, people who could be moved from one place could be moved to another. So we saw that in Islamabad in 85, where when I gave the example of the first labor colony and how that was resettled into like different colonies, one for the Christians and sort of other ones for the Muslims. And those were the ones that were then recognized. But the Sindh Kachiabadi Act never had its, it wasn't applicable to Islamabad, really. So in the way in which residents of Kachi Abadis were able to claim for formalization in places like Karachi, they couldn't claim in the same way in Islamabad, despite having lived there very long. And again, this comes with that idea of like, what, you know, who the city is for, what the city was made for. It was a capital city. It prided itself on being neatly ordered, formalized and green and well-planned. The city had no place for like informal organic sort of settlements. So while, you know, since the 85, CDA had its own programs where it would compensate different villages or abadis to, you know, financially to move elsewhere, or whether it would sort of rehabilitate them in different locations, its primary method of operation was eviction without sort of settlement as well, or, you know, to avoid payment later. And this also thinks, we can also think through this paradigm of looking at Islamabad as a militarized developer state, you know, like, or the city being developed by a militarized developer state, with civil and military bureaucracy work together with private military contractors and city developers to create sort of these dominant land use paradigms of like formalized housing and neatly ordered sectors. You know, now or more recently, you have private housing societies emerging and popping up as well. And most of these cater to the middle class. None of them really cater to the working class or the urban poor. In a place like Islamabad, where I mentioned, where the city itself is small, and because of its size and its orderliness, there is a higher premium to the land within the city. So the city center really is no place for the urban poor. But in 2001, the Sindh Kachi Abadi model finally took place or took shape in Islamabad. And this again was developed or rather pushed forward during the tenure of one of our military dictators, Pervez Musharraf. Musharraf really expanded the Sindh Kachi Abadi Act across the rest of the country as well in a bid to improve his popularity. So that was also a way to improve the democratic face of that military government, really, and to win votes because elections were coming up. And at that time, one of the towns on the outskirts of Islamabad, between Islamabad and Rawalpindi, which was called Alipur Farash Town, that became sort of recognized as a formalized development. And many of the Abadis that were evicted from Islamabad following 2001 were resettled into Alipur Farash Town. Now, we in our project also, and previously AUR members had also had links with people who had been resettled into Alipur Farash Town. And that's a different story. We can talk about how the residents dealt with that resettlement. But it's just to remember that they were contained in a zone outside the city center, very much kettled in a way, you know, away from the premium green lush spaces of Islamabad. This land occupied, like, there was a perception that this land occupied by the toiling classes is going to waste. It could be highly profitable for speculative investment, and it's sort of ruining the character of the city. So there was a bourgeoisie environmentalism sort of understanding of the fact that, you know, these people don't deserve to live here, and they're not doing the city any service by living here. But it's also interesting, I don't want to undermine the fact that activism and the work of a lot of sort of, the city's lawyers and activists and political groups, such as the Awami Worker Party and, you know, the Sindh Alliance for Urban Rights, for example, they did very good work in litigating against CDA's evictions on legal grounds. And many of these evictions were then halted. There was a stay order by the courts that declared these evictions illegal. And that's very important to state as well, the power of activism. But also, again, who is the state? What is the state? Whose interest does it serve? And in the Pakistani context, that's very important because you've got the military, which is a very strong element of the state. Then you've got the political parties who try using the votes of people living in these settlements to mobilize their interests. So when they come into power, they do their best to kind of create some kind of, you know, permanency of tenure or promises of permanency of tenure to people living in these settlements. And then you've got the courts, which are, you know, they're very much in the news right now as well as an institution that tries to keep the state in check, but also wield its power through the regulations and the laws and the sentences it can serve. But, you know, some very interesting anecdotes are also telling, and Hassan can maybe talk about them.
Sobia mentioned, despite the stay order from the court, there is, like, even this year, there's been more than three or four demolition in E12 Abadi, in F11 Abadi. And every time, whenever there is a demolition, so they always call Awami Workers Party activists. So then now you can see we have gone back to the 80s, which Sovia just mentioned. Like now again, we are seeing evictions spree. तो मेरे जहन में वो दो एनेक्डोट वो दो बातें मेरी याद आ रही हैं. मेरा जम है I-9 आबादी का. I-9 आबादी प्रीडोमिनेटली पश्तून कश्मीर मिक्स आबादी है, लेकिन ज़्यादा पश्तून है. तो मेरा जम के साथ काफ़ी मेरा उठना बैठना होता है, तो हमेशा ये बात उससे काफ़ी दफ़ा मैं उससे सुनी है. वो हमेशा वो ये बात करते रहते हैं. 2013-14 में जब नवाज शरीफ की PMLN की हुकूमत थी, तो उन्होंने वो डिमोलिशन के थ्रेट्स काफ़ी ज़्यादा थी. तो उस वक्त CDA की चेयरमैन थी शाइस्ता सुहेल, तो वो TV पे आई थी. उसने इंटरव्यू के दौरान जब एंकर ने उनसे पूछा कि इन लोगों का क्या बनेगा ये जो आबादियों में रहते हैं, तो उस पर उसका जवाब था कि वो जहाँ से आए हैं उधर चले जाएं. इसका मतलब था कि वो खैबर पख्तूनख्वा से आए हैं तो वो उधर चले जाएं, इधर के तो नहीं हैं. तो उसके जवाब में फिर वो मीर आजम को इतना गुस्सा आ जाता था, तो वो कहते थे कि इस्लामाबाद तुम्हारे बाप का है, जिस तरह से तुम दूसरी पाकिस्तान के दूसरे इलाके से आकर इधर आबाद हुई हो, रहती हो, तो हम भी इस तरह से, जिस तरह से जितनी तुम पाकिस्तानी हो उतना हम भी पाकिस्तानी हैं. और इसके अलावा दूसरा जो एनेक्डोट है वो I-11 की आबादी के हवाले से है. I-11 की आबादी को जब मिसमार किया तो ऑपरेशन तकरीबन 4 दिन चला. तो उसमें पुलिस ने ये किया कि वो पिंडी और इस्लामाबाद के मज़ाफात में जितने भी इलाके हैं उसमें उन्होंने वो मस्जिदों में ऐलानात किए, जिसमें उन्होंने लोगों को कहा कि खबरदार, अगर किसी ने I-11 के मुतासिरीन हैं उनको जगह दी अपने इलाके में, उनको टेंट या कहीं झोंपड़ी बनाने की इजाज़त दी, तो उनको भी हिरासत में लिया जाएगा. और यहाँ तक कि मुख्तलिफ जो इस्लामाबाद और रावलपिंडी की चेक पोस्ट हैं उधर पे पुलिस कड़ी होती थी, और वो ये वो उनको मजबूर करती थी कि वो इस्लामाबाद और रावलपिंडी छोड़ के खैबर पख्तूनख्वा सूबे प्रोविंस में चले जाएं.
I'm happy to translate that for you. Hassan has recalled these two very interesting incidents. One relates to the I-9 Abadi in Islamabad, which was evicted in 2013 or 14. And Hassan was recalling how most of the residents were either Pashtun or, you know, from Fatah and other parts of Pakistan, or they were Kashmiri, but they were mostly Pashtun. And in that Abadi, when it was being evicted, the CDA chairman of the time, she made a statement on national television that said, these people should go back to their villages. And this really angered one of the residents, Mir Azam, who was also an activist, and he had learned the sort of activist speak and rights talk from the parties and, you know, the All Pakistan Kachiyawadi Alliance, whom they were working with. And he got very angry and he said, you know, Islamabad tumhare baap ka hai, which means, is Islamabad your father's? And the statement really referred to the fact that Islamabad is a settled city. Nobody really lived there before. And even the CDA chairman had migrated from somewhere to settle there. And it was an outrage about who is she to then tell us to go back to our villages when she herself hasn't gone back to where she's come from. And the second anecdote relates to, again, the role of the state and its lack of care towards the urban settlers, especially the poor. And especially the Pashtun. So this is also particular because Hassan himself is Pashtun, and sort of his experiences is with most of the Pashtun residents who are very open in discussing things with him. So he's talking about the I-11 Abadi, which was mostly settled by people displaced by the conflict around the war on terror and the operation, the Pakistan military operation against it. And this Abadi was destroyed in what was reported in the news also as an operation. So it was a militaristic term to talk about, you know, what happened here. The residents were mostly Pashtun. They were projected as a threat to the rest of the city, a terrorist threat to the rest of the city. And when they were being evicted, they had been filled into vans and buses. And, you know, the police had made an announcement in neighboring sort of mosques within other Kachi Abadis that any residents who allowed I-11 residents to settle within their settlement, to construct a shack or to live in a tent, anyone who aids them or aids their settlement will then be jailed. So this was obviously to reduce the, you know, that sense of sympathy or care, like with, you know, other relatives that might live in other Abadis. But also, you know, they had made up these checkposts at these main entry exit points between Islamabad and Rawalpindi, trying to detract buses from entering and rather routing them towards, you know, the NWFP, which is where most of the other Pashtuns are settled. So there was this clear message to most Pashtuns in the city, especially the working class displaced Pashtuns, that the city was not for them.
You know, it is really telling here that, you know, you have this militarized operation that's going on that, you know, is displacing people from elsewhere, but then they're also being told that they cannot make their homes in Islamabad, that they need to go elsewhere, they need to go back, and they have no place over here. I wanted to ask about the impact of these evictions on the lives and the relationships of people within these communities, and it must have been quite traumatizing. And especially given the not just the physical violence of the evictions, but also the rhetorical violence of the state. So would you be able to kind of talk about what you saw the impacts were on the communities?
Yeah, there is a huge impact of that insecurity on people's lives. I mean, obviously, I mean, they've been living in communities that they've, you know, that they've lived with for years. They know each other's families. All of a sudden, they have to scatter. You know, it's breaking of bonds, bonds that you rely on for many things, childcare, you know, just general security as well, I guess. Many of the people living contiguously next to each other can sometimes be relatives from the same villages, and all of a sudden they're thrown into like distanced spaces with very little access to like transportation routes or like ability to like meet each other again. So it has a huge cost to them personally and obviously financially as well to start over again. And there's a lot of emotional trauma that sort of does generate anger and upset. Like I remember in I visited a community that had been demolished by the CDA in 2019. This was, I think, D12. And, you know, people were so upset. Like, you see this pile of debris with, like, you know, children's school books, with, you know, people's clothes, personal belongings. You know, people were leading me into what used to be their house, and they were recounting exactly where everything used to be. And, you know, this was my lounge, this is where we slept, this is where my kitchen was. Look at my garden, it was so pretty, I had all these flowers. I mean, so obviously, like, it's their home, and it's been violently destroyed, like, without them feeling any agency to stop that destruction from happening. So it was very emotional. And to resettle means to be very far away from your jobs, because in Islamabad, you know, there is no good public transport at all. That's the other thing. You're not walking distance from the places you used to be walking distance to. So despite the trauma, this experience of insecurity, you know, can break community bonds, but sometimes it can strengthen them too. But more often than not, like, I mean, it's usually the marginal communities that suffer the most. And we find these dynamics of exclusion and insecurity very interesting, because they reveal the importance of looking at marginality as an intersectional experience. For example, it can differ from people's, you know, like identification, how they relate to religion or ethnicity or profession. So when Hassan and I were discussing this idea of insecurity, we were talking about how, you know, the Christian communities, like, you know, Rimsha colony, who settled in Rimsha colony, were resettled elsewhere because they were given some kind of protection, understanding that they were a minority, but they had initially suffered that eviction because they were that minority as well. And similarly, the laborers, you know, who were evicted in 1970s from the first labor camp, they were resettled, and their settlements were given permanency because there was an acknowledgement that we need labor in the city. So it was their economic status, really. And it was intersectional because they were from different ethnicities, different religions. And then we find that the Pashtun and Afghan migrants who might have settled in places like I-11 or I-9, they might sort of, you know, they might be Muslim, they might be more affluent because they might have, you know, access to like businesses or small sort of small scale industries. But because they're Pashtun, they might be most marginalized because of the discursive construct of them as violent or as, you know, potential terrorists or as people who don't belong in the city, who are not sort of the kind of citizen that we want in Islamabad. They're mostly male. So, you know, there's many reasons why we need to look at this insecurity from an intersectional lens and to also think about how it generates, you know, these further insecurities, which can sometimes break community bonds in very destructive ways. I mean, Hassan, maybe can give an example of this, perhaps, you know, or maybe add on to something that I have to say.
इससे मुझे याद आता कि जिस तरह से मैंने कहा कि कच्ची आबादी की I-11 कच्ची आबादी की जितनी भी लोग हैं वो ज्यादातर वो इस्लामाबाद की सब्जी मंडी में काम करते हैं. तो अभी जब डिस्प्लेसमेंट के बाद अभी बहुत ज्यादा, क्योंकि उनके साथ काफी ज्यादा लोगों के साथ अभी भी मेरा रहता है, तो जब 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 कभी भी उनसे मिलना होता था तो वो उनमें से बहुत ज्यादा लोग I-11 कच्ची आबादी के पास एक छोटी सा एक फूड डिपार्टमेंट का ऑफिस है, उसके सामने एक छोटा सा गार्डन है. तो वो हर दोपहर को वो सारे जो आबादी वाले हैं उधर बैठते हैं और वो उसकी जो नजरें होती हैं वो आबादी की तरफ होती हैं. वो अभी उधर डेवलप हो गए हैं, उधर घर बने हैं, तो वो कहते हैं इधर तुम्हारा, हमेशा आपस में वो बैठती है, इधर तुम्हारा घर था, इधर था, वो पुरानी जो कहानियां हैं वो सुनाते हैं. और फिर बीच में वो एक बहुत वो नफरत से वो फिर वो बताते हैं कि वो पलाना वो जो बंगला जब दिख रहा है वो मौलवी का है. तो I-11 आबादी में एक मदरसा भी था, मौलवी था, जो जब 2015 में जब डिमोलिशन हो रही थी तो उसमें ये मौलवी और एक दूसरा एक नेबरहुड था, उनको सीडी वालों के उनके साथ बात हो गई थी. तो वो उन्होंने वो किया था कि आप हमारी जो घर है उसको पहले डिमोलिश कर दें. तो उसके बदले में उस मौलवी को सीडी वालों ने एक घर दिया हुआ है जहाँ पे उसने अपने अभी एक बंगला बनाया हुआ है. तो जो आबादी वाले हैं अभी वो उधर बैठ के वो अभी भी अपने जो यादें हैं, उनके बच्चे उधर पैदा हुए हैं, उनकी जवानियां उधर गुजरे हैं, तो वो पुराने वक्त को भी याद करते हैं और वो उस मौलवी को गालियां भी देते हैं उधर से. और ये है कि जब ये ऑपरेशन हुआ तो उसके साथ हमेशा यही होता है कि सारे आबादी वाले लोग जो होते हैं वे इकट्ठे हो जाते हैं. लेकिन इस अगर हम इस मिसाल को देखें तो इधर हमें ये भी देखने को मिलता है कि हमेशा इस तरह से नहीं होता. हमेशा से जो स्टेट एजेंसीज होती हैं या स्टेट होता है हमेशा लोगों को तोड़ने की कोशिश करता है. तो उसके बाद ये जब डिमोलिशन का हुआ था ये ऑपरेशन, इसके बाद लोकल बॉडी इलेक्शन इस्लामाबाद में हुए थे. तो उसका जो अल पाकिस्तान कच्ची आबादी है और अवामी वर्कर पार्टी, हम उसको ये मौका मिला कि ये जितनी भी डिस्प्लेस आबादी है तो हमें मौका मिला कि उनको सब इकट्ठा कर सके. इसी मूवमेंट हमने इसी पे ही डेवलप किया कि हमेशा क्योंकि हमने सुप्रीम कोर्ट में केस डाला हुआ था तो जब भी सुनवाई होती थी तो हम आबादियों में मोबिलाइजेशन करते थे. हालांकि वो बहुत मुश्किल होता था, बहुत फैल गए थे लोग, तो हम जगह जगह जाते थे, लोगों को मोबिलाइज करते थे. तो इसी तरह से इन मीटिंग के थ्रू जितनी आबादियों के लोग हैं वो एक दूसरे को देख लेते थे, एक दूसरे से मिल लेते थे और एक किस्म का जो इलेक्शन आ रहे थे लोकल बॉडी इलेक्शन उसमें भी हमें मौका भी मिला और आबादी भी एक किस्म का उनको अभी तक उनके जो ये रिश्ते बने हुए हैं एक दूसरे से मिलते जुलते हैं, शायद मेरे ख्याल में वही है, वो एक वही रीजन है कि क्योंकि जो पोस्ट डिमोलिशन और इलेक्शन कैंपेन, जब इलेक्शन कैंपेन में हमने दो काउंसलर इलेक्ट किए थे जो कि जिनका ताल्लुक आबादी I-11 आबादी से ही था, तो इसी वजह से चूंकि वो काउंसलर के साथ उनके काम पड़ते थे, उनका स्टैम्प चाहिए होता था, तो एक किस्म का वो एक एंकर पॉइंट था जिसकी वजह से वो एक दूसरे से कनेक्टेड थे.
That was a very interesting intervention. I'll just translate it for ease. So Hassan was recalling how in I-11, the Abadi, the Kachi Abadi that was demolished in 2015, most of the residents that lived there used to work in the Sabzi Mandi, which literally means the vegetable market. And you know, he's still in touch with many of the people who were displaced from that Abadi. And he talks about how despite that it's been so many years on, like more than sort of 5, 6, 7 years on, many of the people who used to live in that Abadi still gather together at one of the offices, the garden of one of the offices from across where their Abadi used to be. And now, you know, they look at when they're sitting there collectively drinking tea, reminiscing, remembering, you know, where they lived, where their houses were. They're looking at these big bungalows that have now been erected where their previous homes were. And they look at it with sort of sadness, but also with a lot of anger and resentment, because one of these bungalows belongs to one of their fellow residents of that Abadi, a Maulvi, who literally means like a religious scholar, or like basically, I wouldn't call him a scholar, but like, I guess a religious leader or someone who maybe sort of is in the mosque perhaps, or has a beard. And they're really upset at him because he had a madrasa, which is like a little school, educational school, a religious school in that neighborhood. And at the time of the demolition, you know, they had the sense of solidarity and an alliance with the Maulvi and sort of the madrasa students as well. And everybody was together that they're going to resist the CDA's efforts. But the CDA backhandedly settled a deal with the Maulvi. And, you know, they had a deal that his would be the first house to be demolished and he will back out from that sort of stand against the CDA. And sort of his backing out meant that sort of the rest of the solidarity also crumbled, and you know, the Abadi succumbed to the eviction and to the demolition. Actually, I shouldn't even call it eviction, it was a violent demolition. And eventually, that Maulvi ended up getting a property, a house within that same Abadi. So it was literally perhaps his own way of cementing his own sort of insecurity or finding security for himself and his home. But at the same time, it was at the cost of the whole community. And, you know, that itself is very upsetting and sad for everyone. And they sit there and, you know, of course, they get upset at him. And that's and Hassan was laughing about that. And I noticed this with people who suffer from violent incidents or witness them as well, that they try to make humor out of that situation. And this was one of those instances where Hassan was laughing and saying, oh, you know, now we can just curse this guy. And, you know, that's what we can do. But, you know, again, it's, you know, it's a very upsetting thing, I'm sure, to experience. He still ended up on a positive note, which is very inspiring for me as well, because he was talking about how, despite sort of being so badly, you know, hurt or treated by one of their comrades, you know, someone who lived within that settlement, he was talking about a different kind of solidarity that emerges. And this was around the local body election in 2015, where, you know, many, the Awami Worker Party and the Alliance for All Pakistan Alliance for Kachi Abadi, you know, they used to bring these displaced people together in like campaigning, you know, with them and sort of, you know, to go to other Abadis and to talk to everyone else about displacement and eviction, how to resist the state. So it was a way of directing that anger and directing that sort of, that political sentiment of being wronged and sort of, you know, trying to claim your rights, sort of, you know, directing into a positive political sort of outcome. And, you know, he mentioned how that sort of collective experience of campaigning together was very healing for many people, because it gave them reason to still come together when they weren't able to come together anymore because of how dispersed they'd become. And it allowed them to kind of reconnect with old comrades, you know, whether they were members of the Workers Party, whether they were members of the Alliance, to sort of recount, keep in touch. And I'll just sort of add to that a little bit, because I recall that when I was doing this project, we hired members from the community as part of the project as researchers as well. And some of these members had been people who had been working, you know, through these sort of moments. Some of them I remember, you know, some of these members that would be people who would have been evicted. I remember sort of also hearing about sort of talking about future projects or potentially things that can be done and worked with many of the people, like trying to you know help them through their work with their experience, but sort of in a way that can be positive for them in some way or the other, that can allow them to reconnect with the people and the communities that they've worked with in the past.
Thank you. I mean, that's a nice segue into, I guess, the last question, which I had, which really builds on what you were saying already, which is to ask you to talk a little bit more about the kinds of survival strategies that the residents of the Kathiyawadis engage in. And I know you're talking about the political mobilization, but I wonder if you wanted to speak a bit more to that.
थोड़ा सा ये वजाहत की भी ज़रूरत है कि हमेशा कच्ची बात के जो लोग होते हैं वो एक पेज पे नहीं होते. बहुत उनको मोबिलाइज करने में भी बहुत जान लगानी होती है और वो खुद उनको जब भी कोई इशू जब तक बहुत संगीन खतरा उनको नहीं नज़र नहीं आता तब तक वो मोबिलाइज इस तरीके से नहीं होते. मेरा खुद अपना जो I-10 आबादी के साथ जो एक एक्टिविस्ट हैं इमरान, उसके साथ काफ़ी ये डिस्कशन होती है और उसके साथ वो काफ़ी जब भी हम अवामी वर्कर पार्टी की मीटिंग्स हो गई, क्योंकि जब भी उनको कोई ख़तरा होता है या इलेक्शन जब नज़दीक आते हैं या ये रेगुलरली हम उधर हमारी जो मीटिंग्स होती हैं उसके हवाले से जब हम उनको अप्रोच करते हैं कि एक मीटिंग ऑर्गेनाइज करें, तो वो चूंकि अभी उसके साथ हमारी काफ़ी अरसे से काम करते हैं तो वो कुल की बात वो अभी होती है. वो खुद बताते हैं कि बहुत बुरे हालात हैं, लोग पीछे जाना पड़ता है, उसकी मेहनत समाजती करनी पड़ती है कि फलानत दिन को मैं मीटिंग रख रहा हूँ. हालांकि वो चाय पानी भी खुद ही सब कुछ करता है, वो ये भी नहीं होता कि कोई पैसों का कुछ होता है, लेकिन वो उसको बहुत मुश्किल होती थी वो क्या लोगों को मीटिंग पे बुलाने के लिए, लोगों को बिठाने के लिए. तो जब तक लोगों के सर पे मतलब जब खतरा इवेक्शन का हो या कोई और इस तरह से पुलिस के छापे जब पड़ते हैं या इस तरह का कोई संगीन वाक्या होता है या कोई नेबरिंग जो क्योंकि ये जो I-10 की आबादी है बिल्कुल ही नाले के ऊपर है और आसपास अभी ये हो रहा है कि जो घर बने हुए हैं तो वो अलग से वो अपने घरों को कि जो उनका जो घर है उनकी दीवारें वो आगे कर रहे हैं, तो जो कच्ची आबादी के लोग हैं उनकी घरों को फिर वो मिसमार करते हैं. तो जब इस तरह के थ्रेड्स आते हैं साथ वाले जो सेक्टर की जो फॉर्मल रेजिडेंट हैं उनकी तरफ से, फिर वो इस तरह से वो मोबिलाइज होते हैं या फिर वो मीटिंग होती हैं. उसके अलावा आम हालात में जब कोई उनको खतरा नहीं होता तो बहुत मुश्किल होती है लोगों को मोबिलाइज करने में या उनको जब हमारा अपना भी पार्टी का भी या कोई इवेंट होता है जब हम उसमें इनवाइट करते हैं, ट्रांसपोर्ट का भी उनको वो करते हैं मतलब हम मुहैया करते हैं, तब भी बहुत मुश्किल होती है जो लोकल एक्टिविस्ट हैं उनको प्रोटेस्ट में लाने के लिए. तो ये जाहिर है मेरे ख्याल में तो मैं ये कह सकता हूँ कि चूंकि सब इनफॉर्मल काम से जुड़े हुए हैं तो ज्यादातर लोग दिहाड़ी में ही मसरूफ होते होंगे. मुझे ये लगता है कि ज्यादा यही इशू होता है, ज्यादातर I-10 की आबादी का है भी बहुत ज्यादा स्क्रैप का कारोबार करते हैं. मेरे ख्याल में सबसे गरीब आबादी यही है, तो एक शायद ये मेरे ख्याल में तो ये एक जवाब हो सकता है कि रीजन हो सकता है कि इस वजह से. लेकिन जनरली ये है कि जब कोई खतरा या इस तरह के कुछ वो नहीं होता तो तब उनको मोबिलाइज करना या खुद वो मोबिलाइज इस तरह आसानी से नहीं होते.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Just to translate, Hassan was talking about how sometimes some of the community members who are also activists within the AUR find it very difficult to mobilize and bring people together And he says that, you know, usually that happens when times are good, because, you know, also he recognizes that many of the people working there are, you know, they're informal, working in the informal economy. You know, they have their own work to look after. They know that they, if they don't work, they don't get paid, and, you know, they don't have the time to come out and attend these meetings. And this can be a bit difficult sometimes, because sometimes you want to keep that sort of solidarity and momentum going despite, you know, outside of crisis moments as well. But he also says that, you know, usually when things come, you know, become hard, when they move to a serious situation, and when communities are actively under threat, then they do come together, and they come together very quickly. And they do this, you know, in instances when there's police convictions, or if there's any sort of operations of evictions, or if there's any expansion on the side of neighboring formal neighborhoods who might be extending their outside boundary walls into the spaces of these informal sort of kachiabadis. So at moments like that, people do really come together. I just wanted to add to that a little bit. So, you know, some of the survival strategies that people have also include tapping into their social capital. So, you know, they have very good relationships and ties with property dealers and small businesses within their local small markets. So they are sort of, you know, fully fledged communities. When we think kachiabadis, we imagine sort of spaces that are just sort of settlement or shack huts, but, you know, they're very established communities with their own little markets and their own little sort of economies as well. And the property dealers and small businesses within these markets, like Hassan was mentioning, the scrap market or the scrap work, you know, they wield a lot of influence and power, like in different ways, you know, through their connections with local politicians, or through their connections with like CDA workers or recycling plants or whoever it is. And these kinds of modes of connection can sometimes be very useful and helpful, especially when they have to access state officials or political parties or workers' unions. You know, often these people stand for elections, but they can also help lobby on behalf of these groups. The other sort of survival strategy I was thinking about was also, I don't know if, you know, it's particular to some settlements, but some of these people work within the CDA, which is the Capital Development Authority. Now, this sounds a bit like what? But, you know, I remember in one of the communities that I went, the person I was speaking to, who was like leading me around, like he literally picked up my phone call, said, come, I'll show you, like, you know, I want to visit my settlement. I want to show you what's happening. This is when it was demolished. This was the D12 one. And he was leading me through the different houses. And he was, when I asked him what he does, he said he was a gardener within the CDA. And I found this very interesting, because I also realized that, you know, his ability to kind of do that labor of like invite people into the settlement, like speak to them, talk to them about what's happened, articulate the problem, also connected to this sort of understanding of how to make a claim and how to project your right to an audience that might be academic, an audience that might be a journalist, an audience that might be a political worker. And also because they might have had informal connections with sort of secretary, you know, sort of administrative officers within the CDA as well, so they know their rights. And the language that he was speaking was quite knowledgeable, you know, like, so he was talking about, he was making me meet with some of the women in the settlement who were living by themselves. There was a claim of like, you're a woman, now you can speak to this other woman. And she was talking about all the legal, like she had all these legal like documents that she was mentioning and happy to show me. And it was quite interesting for me, because that assumption of the women living in these settlements not being sort of, you know, but she was also talking about how she lives alone here, and now without a roof over her head, like with her living with her children, like she doesn't feel safe. So, I mean, it's just that sense of like, you know, using their social capital to kind of make connections and talk about and highlight their issues. Political alliances are very important as well. You know, the loyalty to political parties is not always ideologically rooted, but, you know, it's about knowledge of who has access to power and who can help them access rights. So it's a very pragmatic and instrumental approach. And this sort of includes often, Hassan was mentioning in a previous conversation with me, how it's sometimes not just linked to displacement, but also linked to access to justice or escape from police or courts. So, for example, Hassan is a member of one of the political parties that you probably heard him say, which was the Awami Worker Party. But there are other mainstream parties like the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf or the PMLN, or, you know, and often some of these people might support the AWP for all the work it does in mobilizing and sort of, because a lot of members of the AWP are also members of the AUR. So they know that these people are committed to workers' rights. They're the only pretty much, socialist party within Islamabad at the moment. But at the same time, many people are also pragmatic because they know that this party is always, you know, it's on the wrong books of the police and the state. So it's not sort of always favored by the state. It's really a pest for the state, you know. So if they want to get out of jail, you know, these guys can stand outside the press club and like hold placards and like, you know, raise hell. And some of them are professors, some of them are journalists. So they can access those sort of activist mediums. But, you know, to really get them unlocked from jail would mean talk to someone who has a brother, you know, in the police, or, you know, someone who's giving money to the police. So they know, they're very pragmatic in their approach of who to support and how to support and how to get their sort of voice. So, yeah, I mean, there is a lot about sort of, you know, the whole vote bank politics that comes into play, but also pragmatically sort of instrumentally thinking about who can help them best.
I have something to add. Residents of Kachiabadis are quite diverse. Like, they come from different ethnicities, Kashmiris, Pashtuns, Punjabis, and also from different religions, Muslims and Christian. So when in 2013 and 14, when the residents of the Badis started getting eviction threats. So at that time, Al Pakistan Kachiabadi Alliance, they used to organize meetings in different Abadis. So what happened we used to organize not only meetings, but also jalsas in all the Abadis. And we would invite all of the residents of different Abadis. So what happened during this time that there was this solidarity across the religions and ethnicities. They started knowing each other, and then this somehow with the passage of time, they started like bonding and also like sharing resources with each other. So the Al Pakistan Kachiabadi Alliance platform and AWP, they provided that platform where they can extend solidarities with each other. So it was not like it was not easy for the state or police or other agencies to divide the communities on the basis of the sects, religion and ethnicity.
This has been such an interesting conversation. I know we've been talking about this earlier, that, you know, there's just so much to unpack here. And I know that you have a lot of things that you have planned for the project that you've done. But I wanted to thank the both of you for sharing your insights and your experiences today. And the other thing that I also wanted to say is that, you know, this has been particularly important and useful because for much of this podcast, as it has gone on, I have talked very much to people who have worked with refugees or, you know, with other kinds of forced migrants understood in a very particular way. But what your discussion really brings to light is the ways in which cities are also places of displacement, of continuous displacement, of continuous insecurity, of politics that move people out of their homes in very similar ways to the forced displacement of people across borders or across different parts of a country. And I think that that's a really important lens to bring in, that when we're talking about displacement, we're not just talking about very specific kinds of displacement. Like, we cannot think about displacement in only one way. We can't just think about it as people being displaced out of very particular kinds of conflict or very particular kinds of crises, but also think about how that is connected with other forms of displacement that happen on an everyday basis and in other parts of the world, like in cities and so forth, to the residents, to citizens, and how that affects the ways in which you think about yourself as a citizen, not just of a country, but also of a city. I mean, I really appreciated that conversation about, you know, how people are told whether they belong in Islamabad or not. I think that was a really fascinating conversation, and you know, how they state their rights to the city through these kinds of political mobilizations, through their engagements with different authorities and figures within these organizations as well. So this has been a really rich and interesting conversation. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ramola. That was, you know, very kind of you to invite us to help, you know, to help us remind us what we're doing and also to speak about a city. And like you said, it's also very, you know, very urban in what's happening in terms of the way Hassan was talking about different people that are coming together, like, you know, the intersectional lens of like, you know, what it means to be insecure or marginal, thinking about the forms of survival, strategy, collaboration, but competitiveness. I mean, all of that is something that you would find in cities. And that's what makes, you know, this a very interesting place to look at, to work with, but also to work with great people like Hassan and the AUR. It's really been a pleasure. Do check out the website that we formed as part of this project, www.aur.pk.
बहुत शुक्रिया मुझे सूबिया दोनों को इनवाइट करने का आपकी प्रोग्राम के साथ साथ से मैं अपने जितने भी दोस्त हैं जो अभी तक इस काम को मैं बिजी हैं वो काम कर रहे हैं और कम्युनिटी के साथ इसके बावजूद के काफी मुश्किल हो गया है पाकिस्तान के जिस तरह के हालात है तो एक्टिविस्टों को भी इस तरह का काम मोबिलाइजेशन का काम करने में काफी दुश्वारी आ रही है तो हमारे एयूआर की कुछ दोस्त अभी भी इस प्रोजेक्ट में अभी भी बिजी हैं खासकर अभी पिछले कुछ दिनों से ये हुआ है कि इस्लामाबाद में वेस्ट डिस्पोजल का एक जगह थी उसको एक पिंडी के मुजफ्फरपुर में उधर एक उनके लिए जगह बना दी है तो उधर वो वेस्ट को उधर वो शिफ्ट कर रहे हैं तो उसमें काफी एक्टिव हैं उसके खिलाफ उधर लोकल जो आबादी है वो काफी अरसे से उन्होंने केस भी डाला हुआ है और वो मोबिलाइजेशन भी कर रही है तो हमारे EUR के एक्टिविस्ट आयशा हो गई वो काफी अरसे से बिजी हैं EIA की जो मीटिंग्स हैं वो इवेंट्स हैं उसको कवर करती हैं और काफी अरसे से हम उसकी खिलाफ ऑनलाइन और कम्युनिटी के साथ भी मोबिलाइजेशन कर रहे हैं तो उम्मीद है इस तरह के प्रोग्राम जो होंगे वो हमारे जी जो काम है उसको लोगों के सामने आने में मदद देगी बहुत शुक्रिया
थैंक यू सो मच हसन आई रियली अप्रिशिएट दैट and again thank you both I'm really honored to be able to give this as a platform to the work to all the activists and the organizations that you mentioned so thank you so much
thank you Ramola